listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Previously broadcast program.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihera Zazan. When the Palestinian Nakba, or the catastrophe of 1948, is discussed, it's commonly understood to refer to the destruction of villages and the displacement of about 700,000 Palestinians. What gets left out is what happened to the people who remained in the borders of what became Israel and the transformations the new state created on the land, natural resources, the public space, and urban development. On this week's program, Mira Nabulsi is joined by Palestinian architect and urban planner Lama Shahade to discuss Israel's settler colonial project and how it manifests itself in urban planning within the 1948 territories and how it impacted Palestinian citizens of Israel.
When we talk about ethnic cleansing and Nakba, they're most commonly discussed in terms of the destruction of villages and the removal of people. But what's missing usually is how Israel changed the topography of the land and what happened to the people who remained in historic Palestine. From your perspective as an urban planner, talk to us about the early years of the State of Israel.
Actually, that's a good way to start maybe the interview, because people usually see Palestine as what's happening in the West Bank and Gaza. And what happened in historic Palestine is history. It's done. Israel just occupied the land and that's it. But if we see what Israel did since 1948 or even before until today, what Israel is continuing to do in historic Palestine, we can understand the patterns of occupation that are happening in the West Bank and Gaza because of the many similarities and because of its one settler colonial state. For us, it's one Palestine, but also it's one settler colonial state. Basically, in 1948, as you know, 700,000 Palestinians were expelled. That's around 50% of the population of historic Palestine. Today, we are 1.5 million citizens. We got the citizenship. That's the status of Palestinians who remained. Most of us live in only Palestinian communities. We call them villages or towns because it's basically villages that grew into dense towns, but still in a village, let's say, traditional way of living. And it's Palestinian-only communities. Few of us, around maybe 15% or so, live in mixed cities, Jewish and Palestinian population, like the historic cities, Haifa, Yaffa, Akka, and those cities. So if we want to talk about the start of Israelis building the state of Israel, what happened almost right after 1948 is that Israel claimed ownership over 93% of the land, which is huge percentage. I'm talking about the land within historic Palestine, the borders of pre-1967. And 1930% as public land is a huge number compared to all other countries in the world. And there were many laws that allowed the Israeli government to claim the ownership over those lands. Maybe we'll talk about them later, but this fact allowed basically the Israelis to see the land as like white canvas. It's all for them, so they can plan whatever they want. And Palestinians during this period, after 1948, were put under military government for 20 years. So the first 20 years, we were basically in a big open jail. If we want to leave the village or work in other places, we had to get permissions. It's like the West Bank today, kind of, with the soldiers around the villages, etc. And this is when basically Israel started distributing the population, building cities, towns, infrastructure, industrial zones, and taking over natural resources, and also legislating new laws and expropriating whatever land is left according to their new laws. Within those black holes, us, the Palestinians' villages, we were left on 3% of the land only. That is our private land that were not stolen, kind of survived. And we grew 8 times more than what we were within this period of time, but only within those borders.
So between 1948 and now, you're saying the population of Palestinians inside Israel grew 8 times.
Around 8 times more. Mm-hmm. I think it's even 9 times more. Almost without any expanding of the borders of those villages. We still live only on our private lands. Israelis do not allow or do not give up. The word give up is wrong, like giving up on public land in order for our villages to expand. Those are our historic lands, but we're not allowed to claim them back, or we're not allowed to build on them. They're just don't belong to us anymore. During this time, basically, we see how those small villages are surrounded by highways, by new Jewish settlements or agricultural lands that don't belong to us. It's not ours. And within our villages, we grew very densely because we don't have any other option. So whoever has land will build houses on their land for just the need of housing. And then you will see those black holes as more like yellowish satellite images because of the very dense housing without public space, without parks, without agricultural lands. We don't have agriculture anymore because we lost the lands, but also whatever is left is now for building houses. So you'll see those dense houses, and then you'll see the next Jewish settlements as a very modern planned cities. So that's basically what, if we want to see what happened to the map or to the satellite image of historic Palestine as Israel continues to grow.
I want to go back a little bit to the beginning of the state of Israel, and I wanted to kind of get an idea about the early Jewish settlements. Israel doubled its population within the first 3 years following the state declaration in 1948. So how did it prepare for the sudden growth of a population with all the Jewish immigration that came to Palestine? And you started to talk a little bit about what started happening to Palestinians, but how was Israel preparing for this large growth of population in the early years?
Okay, if we continue from the fact that Israel now owns 93% of the land and they can plan wherever they want, so we can talk about the patterns of planning that they used. First, the Zionist movement, the Jewish National Fund, and all those institutions that worked in Palestine before the, let's say, the formal state of Israel, they all worked on preparing the land for the new immigrants. Well, they used agriculture as one main option for food security and also for employment for the new immigrants. So they tried to distribute agricultural lands all over the place and to claim land by agriculture. But that's more for, let's say, employment. But for populating the immigrants, they started building cities. Here we can talk about different patterns. We can start with Ben-Gurion, who's the Zionist leader then, that wanted to bloom the Negev, the Nakab, the desert of southern Palestine. That was one of the national goals of the early stages of Israel. Because the desert is empty, they saw this as a threat. Well, it wasn't empty, it became empty. From 100,000 to 11,000 remained only within 1 year, basically. And they saw it as an opportunity of security, economic mission, and building new towns there, new settlements. So that was one goal. And by allowing water to, well, they also took over natural resources, so they were able to transform water from the rich north to the desert, and they started building settlements. Only by 1960, 1961, we're talking about only 13 years of Israel, there were already 73 Jewish settlements in the desert. That's a big number. Some of them are Jewish development towns. I'll talk about this in a bit. And some of them are collective agricultural lands or communities. That's the kibbutz. Also, we can talk a little bit about the kibbutz, how they built those type of settlements, so on, like industrial zones for the new population, etc. That's first, the desert, the empty lands as they saw it. But also, as I say, they built agriculture and rural development. What they wanted is basically to claim the land to prevent the return to the 1949 UN partition line. Because in 1948, they basically declared the Israeli state over a larger area. So they have now more lands. They don't want to go back to the UN partition, the 1947 line, sorry. So what they did is they distributed the agricultural settlements along the borders as buffer zones between, let's say, Gaza and the desert, between Jordan and the West Bank. So wherever they were able to distribute agricultural settlements, they did. They distributed the population too. And they had this model of socialist communal living that's called the kibbutz, where they all farm the land and then they live together in those small kibbutz or cooperative settlements, and the new immigrants will work for them. But the big wave of new immigrants were distributed to the what they call development towns, and that's another pattern. So that pattern is basically following the dispersal policy. They didn't build big cities. They didn't build another Tel Aviv. What they built is a very low dense towns so they can basically claim more land. And those new development towns were distributed all over the map. So you'll see them in the Galilee area, along the border with Lebanon, the border with the West Bank then, and the desert. And to those new towns, they send the Mizrahi Jews, the Jewish coming from Arab and Islamic countries. They were not as strong as the Ashkenazi Jews coming from Europe, even before 1948. But those were mostly poor Jewish people coming from Arab countries. They had nothing. They started distributing them in those, wherever they saw a potential for new development town. The towns were nothing yet. They were just like tents or empty lands. So they sent this big wave of immigrants to those towns and they forced them to build the towns. And many of them, they were shocked. You told us that we're going to the Holy Land, to the new Israeli state. Their life will be better in the new land. But then they realized that they were sent to work and build the country. And many of them left or did not want to go. They sent them by buses. They didn't want to leave the bus. No, it's empty. We don't want to live here. It's not a town even. We don't want to build this place. And some of them tried to live in some of the Palestinian demolished houses or demolished neighborhoods like Wadi Salib in Haifa, like Lifta in Jerusalem, because they looked like Arab architecture. They occupied it again, and then they were forced to leave them again. So like Wadi Salib and Lifta were basically, people were expelled from there twice. So that's another pattern is the development towns. But with those towns, they distributed them far from main cities, as I said. They did not rely on agricultural economy, and they did not have any other alternative. So they became very poor towns until today. They're not like good place to live. And they try to do many things like to change the stereotype over the development towns, but still. And when Israel distributed the population, they also distributed it very ethnically, not just for Jewish versus Palestinian, but also Mizrahi Jewish versus Ashkenazi Jewish, Russian Jewish, Ethiopian Jewish that came later to Palestine. So that was also another pattern.
What about the other Jewish communities? Like, is there a specific kind of pattern that you notice in terms of how they were distributed? Like, were the Western Europeans, the Ashkenazi, sent to larger urban centers that already existed? Can you give an idea about that too?
As far as I know, the big waves of Jewish immigrants from Europe arrived to Palestine before 1948. And then they were sent to the urban cities that were already mixed, because during the British Mandate, before Israel, basically Jewish people lived along Palestinian, sometimes in the same neighborhoods as Palestinians, sometimes in their own new neighborhoods that they built, because the British Mandate allowed them to build and to take over some parts of the cities, let's say in Haifa and Yaffa, where Tel Aviv was built also during the British Mandate. So European Jewish were sent there and to the agricultural settlements. And the agricultural settlements, they are among the elite of the Jewish community today, not because of the fact that they are rich, but because by then the agriculture was a big thing. They took over resources. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of hectares for every single community, 300 people living in an area that's larger than a big Palestinian village. So those resources are still for them today. So they have enough money, not just from agriculture, but also from selling the land or building industrial areas over those lands, etc. So this is where the European Jewish lived. And the Mizrahi Jewish basically were sent to the development towns, that's mainly. I don't know about the difference between the different European regions, like West Europe versus East Europe. I'm not sure, but I know the difference between Mizrahi Jews versus European Jews. And later on, the other waves of the big Russian immigration that happened after the fall of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, those were sent to new neighborhoods in urban centers. After they established those towns and settlements, etc., Israel transferred into being more urban. They don't follow the dispersal policy anymore. They don't need it. They claimed the land. So now they want more efficiency. They want modern cities. Well, they still build different patterns, but they don't need it anymore as they needed it then. They expand cities and build neighborhoods. And then, let's say in Haifa, they built a new neighborhood. They sent Russians there, Ethiopians. They sent them to this neighborhood. And then you'll see it's very similar to the U.S. cities in this terms. Like, you'll see neighborhoods that speak one language. The city itself is mixed, but it's segregated within. Exactly. And same with Palestinians that later were able to live in those mixed cities. We also live in segregated neighborhoods.
I wanted to touch on the issue of land. You were starting to talk about that, the issue of land ownership. So what happened to the lands, and what legal channels did Israel use to transfer ownership from Palestinians who lived and farmed these lands to Israeli ownership? And I presume perhaps at the beginning, state ownership. There are specific laws that you can tell us about that Israel used in the process of transferring ownership.
First, one of the main methods was the absentees law. That was in 1950. Let's say it defines basically persons who were expelled from Palestine as absentees. They say that whoever who left this area after November 1947 is absentee, and the property that they owned, whether it's land or houses, whatever, is now placed under the control of the state of Israel. In that way, they basically took all over the lands of the demolished Palestinian villages, many houses within the remained Palestinian villages, and all the Palestinian historic cities, the Arab neighborhoods in Haifa and Yaffa, all of the cities that were demolished completely. So that's how they took those lands and properties. Also, they transferred the ownership of every land that was not previously claimed according to the British law of ownership, which is different than the Ottoman law. So according to the Ottoman law that we lived under for hundreds of years, and then the land was not a property as it's seen in the Western planning system. The land is like the natural resource that is, it's public, it's for everyone. So if you work the land, if you're a farmer or whatever, if you work the land, you can eat from what you did, you can sell them, you can do whatever you want to. So people treated the land in this way. Many farmers worked different lands. They knew, like, this village has this area, they own this area, but it was not written anywhere. Well, part of them. part of them were written under different system of the Ottoman law that the British law does not recognize. So all this paperwork that we have today, it means nothing for the Israeli courts because they just followed the British law. So in this way, we lost another big areas of historic Palestine. They say it's not written and it's not, the British law does not recognize this kind of ownership, so it's not yours. And it became a state land. Also, when we lived under the Ottoman, let's say, or the British mandate, even if this land was not owned by Palestinians, like private ownership, because it was not a thing. But you still can, let's say, go there, graze the land, let's say, with if people had herd or whatever, they still can use it. But now when it transferred to Israel, Israel sees it as a property and then they build on it. You're not allowed there. And yeah, another thing that I didn't mention earlier about the patterns that Israel used for building this those settlements is that also in many of those settlements, well, most of them, they have committees that do not allow people to rent a house or to buy a house unless the committee says yes. So this is how also we as Palestinians cannot say, oh, I want to go and live in a Jewish settlement.
These committees are basically from the residents of a certain area?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because those were the pioneers that established that place. So they have the right to say who's going to live there or not. And it's our lands again, but yeah, you're not allowed to buy a house there. In other cities or development towns or whatever, there are no committees and it's open, but then you have all the other obstacles of living there because of racism or they don't sell you the house. That's like someone will not sell you a house. That's very easy to do. And we don't have schools there, facilities, you know, but we speak Arabic. We want to learn in Arabic schools, etc. So in all those cities, we don't have what we need. Mm-hmm. So we don't live there. To continue about how they took the, transferred the ownership. So yeah, the unclaimed, let's say, ownership and the absentees law, but also the Jewish National Fund that was established in 1900, very early by the Zionist Congress then. And they were responsible for purchasing land in Palestine. So they use this as like, oh, you sold the land, etc. It's not, first of all, it's not a high percentage at all of the lands that they took, but it was one method. But also they used many ways. They were single person that wanted to buy land or to purchase land. Also the land ownership then was one person may own the whole village and then people were farmers. They worked the land.
Feudal
yeah,
system.
And then... And those people were very rich. They lived abroad also. They didn't live in Palestine. So some of them sold part of the land. But it's not the big percentage of the ownership transferred to the Israeli state. Those lands, they now they're owned by the state of Israel and they have different legislations of who can use it. So by definition, only for Jewish people, for Jewish immigrants and not for others. So they will not expand a Palestinian village on those lands. Each land falls under different law, even if it's all under the state of Israel ownership. It's very ethnic, racial planning system, but yeah, still. But for the planning itself, that's for the ownership. For the planning itself or how they allowed all this to happen, there are other laws, like how they took over natural resources, let's say how they transferred the water from a public resource that you can use to a very central system that only the
Yes, I was going to actually ask you about the water, especially you were starting to talk about the Naqab or the Negev desert and this whole idea of Israel made the desert bloom, which became perhaps also normalized internationally. I wanted us to talk a little bit about the cost of what that meant for the water sources. And I wanted us to kind of understand a little bit, how did Palestinians use these water sources before? And what happened to them once Israel got into this whole project of turning the Negev Desert, one of its early projects, to
First, Palestinians, like all other people then, we used water locally. We lived based on natural resources. That's how human beings basically moved along this planet. They looked for resources, they lived near them, and they used them. But what Israel did as a colonial system is that they don't care where the resources are. they see everything from above. So for them, this amount of water in Palestine, it doesn't matter where, they can use technology or whatever infrastructure, they can get enough money to build huge infrastructure and to transfer the water from wherever they want. And that's how they saw this. They see it as a very modern, developed technology that they teach it to the world. They teach it as a very successful thing that they did, that they transferred water from the rich north to the desert. First of all, they had the new law, the water law, that removed all private or collective property rights over water resources. And they said water resources that are like springs, streams, rivers, lakes, whatever, underground or above ground water, is now all under the ownership of the state. And they had new government companies that control it and allocate the water resources, etc. And they built the national water carrier from the Jordanian River to the desert. And the Jordanian River is shared by Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, and Jordan too. But no one cares. Israel is just took the water from the Tiberias lake that they occupied, and they transformed the water to the desert. And to do that, they built a dam at the southern part of the lake, and they prevented the Jordanian River to continue to the Dead Sea. And now the Dead Sea is 35% of its area is dry, and it's artificial now. So that's one basically cost of that project, that we lost the only place on earth, the Dead Sea. There's nothing like this in any other place but Palestine. So we lost it. And also we got dry rivers, dry streams. The main rivers at the center or the north, they got only 5% of their original flow or 2% of their original flow. It was a drought, basically, all over Palestine. And now they realized that they exploited natural resources, not just because they transferred water from north to south, but because of this rapid urbanization of the whole place. When we say that they doubled the population, it's not a natural process. It's just bringing too many people and building industrial zones and making them live in a very modern lifestyle too. But also, even if they didn't live the modern lifestyle, the other lifestyle, like the agriculture, they didn't see agriculture as part of working the land. They saw it as a capitalist workshop too. The Jewish agriculture project that they're very proud of, and they talk about it, they teach about it again to people around the world. They bring people from all over the world to help them in agricultural cities and settlements as a national icon for Israelis. Those agricultural lands consumed 90% of water resources in Palestine. And that got us to the fact that we don't have water anymore. And now Israel is treating seawater and treating saline underground water. So we don't drink natural water anymore. Now, I think more than 60% of agricultural lands are getting recycled water. And 80% of household consumption is seawater treated water and not natural water resources, which is again relying on technology and chemicals in order to live after exploiting the water resources and making this natural transformation of the area. Now we're again living under a place where we rely on electricity in order to drink. And when they took over the water resources, they also demolished many of the water facilities, local pools that were in every village for animals to drink or for people to wash their clothes, whatever. They demolished those places. They also closed all the springs because villages were built around springs. Mm-hmm. So they closed the springs and that's it. You're not allowed to take water anymore. And the only water that you can drink or use is whatever flows to your house, and then it's allocated by the government companies. The national water carrier, it doesn't work anymore because they don't have enough water. What they do is that they transfer water from the sea to the center. So it's like going now from west to east instead of north to south.
So did they abandon this whole idea about continuing to make the Negev Desert green? How can they continue with that project? Because if they...
They didn't stop that project. There is enough treated water for that project. The main thing is always the Zionist project. Whatever they need for that, they will find a solution for it. It's very sad what's happening in the desert. They also planted forests to claim land so the desert will become green. They have large areas of agricultural lands too. So if you go to Google Maps, you go to satellite image, see the border with Gaza, and you'll be shocked, like, what is this? Like, one agricultural land is the same area as a Palestinian camp in Gaza, but it's all one color because it's owned by one maybe person that is benefiting from the profit of this land. Now, instead of encouraging people to go to the desert for agriculture or for the national goals, now they're trying to encourage them by high-tech parks, high-tech cities. They're building new cities for people who work for those big high-tech companies, and they're encouraging them to go to the desert. They can subsidize many projects and encourage investors to build there. They're still building. And what's happening to Palestinians there is a sad story of our Nakba that's still ongoing, because there are Palestinian Bedouins living there, and there are tens of dozens of villages that are still unrecognized. When I say unrecognized village, it means that Israel doesn't see it as a legal place, but their historic village, they lived there. But again, as I say, the Ottoman law was different than the British laws, and then they don't recognize the paperwork that those people have. For the Israelis, those people don't own the land, and they have to move. And they built seven new, well, not new anymore, but seven cities to concentrate the Bedouins, to prevent them from living all over the desert, mm-hmm. although they don't really live all over the desert but anymore, because they forced them to move and they expelled them from all over the place. But they want to concentrate them even more. And they demolished already many, many villages, and they continue to do that. And those unrecognized villages don't have water system, don't have electricity, they don't have nothing, and they're under the threat of being demolished. What they want is basically to make those people move to the new cities. And those new cities are awful. So they use the tribal system that the Bedouin community is known as, and then they give like every tribe a neighborhood. Imagine like Bedouin people moving from living within the desert, working the
nomadic
land.
Nomadic caste.
Nomadic. Well, not very nomadic, but at least connected to nature. But then they force them into like this small parcels where each family has one parcel. You'll see a very high percentage of crime rates, poverty. Those places are awful. So no one wants also to move to those models, to those new cities. Even if they're good, people have the right not to move there, because they have the right to live at their historic villages. This is their land. But even if, let's say, people want to give up on their land, the solutions are awful. People cannot live under those conditions.
That is Lama Shahadeh speaking with Mira Nabulsi about Israel's settler colonial project and how it manifests itself in urban planning within the 1948 territories and how it impacted Palestinian citizens of Israel. We'll hear more after a break from Pacifica Radio. This is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
That the approach, and you definitely alluded to that a lot, which is the approach that Israel has historically used, is very similar to European colonialism when working with nature. So instead of nature being, you know, similar to how indigenous communities lived here and in different parts of the world, much more in unity and in tandem with nature, we're talking about an approach that is basically commodifying water and natural resources and has a different idea of nature that is much more based off control and making money. And that speaks to so much of, I think, what you were saying. I want us to move to talk a little bit about basically the differences in urban planning between Jewish towns and Palestinian towns. And I'm thinking zoning, plans, maps, construction and development. And how does it differ between Jewish-Israeli urban centers and Palestinian?
When we talk about Jewish urban planning, we're talking about planning from zero on empty lands. So it's very easy, very central, very Western. It's like you have this engineer or urban planner that comes and draw the neighborhoods, decide what will be where, the streets network, whatever, and it's all public owned. So it's very easy later to control who live where and how to allocate all those resources within the cities. But then if we compare this to the planning system that works, the same planning system, by the way, it's the same law. We're still under the Israeli law, but then it's a law that came from above and was forced on us. It works differently then because we live on our private owned land, which means like my family owns this one dunam of land. We have our house, our grandfather house, whatever, in one very particular square. And then for the Israelis, they know that, okay, if you want to build a house, you have to get a permit to build the house. And to get a permit to build a house, it means that there should be a master plan for that area. To have a master plan for that area means that someone has to come and draw the map and plan it, do like the zoning thing. Where's the industrial zone? Where's the residential zone? What's allowed here, there? Where's the street, the network, etc. But they did not do that until after 2000, which means that we lived for decades in unplanned places. Unplanned places means that it's okay to live in an unplanned place. I'm not saying that planning is the best way, but if you live freely in that unplanned place, at least you can have your own system or your own whatever communal system of allocating land, of real estate system, of a way to build houses, etc. But we lived in those closed borders where we cannot expand them. The only thing that we could do was to build our private houses on top of our parents' house or on our agricultural land that we don't need it anymore because it's not profit anymore. And we have to have a house. So that's a priority now. So people transferred those agricultural lands into houses and the next generation built another layer of houses. So those areas became very dense. And now if you come to those places and try to do the master plan, it's ridiculous because where you can have a street, where can you decide on an industrial zone? Like how can you do an industrial zone or plan a zone in a place that is all built already? And the facilities that are not residential are mixed within those residential areas. You'll see people's businesses under their houses, which is the only way for them to open the business. It has to be in their house. But then mixed-use planning is a good thing, but it's good when you have good infrastructure for it, but not when it's in very narrow streets and those old cities, old villages where you can't even park your car. And add to this the amount of cars that now we need that made all this place very, very hard to live in. We don't have public transportation because the regulations for bus lines cannot work on those villages. You don't have enough space in the street. You can't build the station, the bus stops, etc. Until very, very recently, 99% of the Palestinian villages did not have bus lines, which means that you cannot even go to your work. So you have to have a car, which made many, many women unemployed. We have the highest percentage of unemployed women compared to all Palestinians living in Gaza or West Bank even. And high rate of poverty too, because in those villages, when you don't expand the border, it's not because we want to live in undense places, but we want resources. When you expand borders and, you know, build industrial zones, build schools, all those facilities that you need, you also get profit from this. You have places to work. You have schools to go to. You have parks. You have sports facilities, etc. Our villages lack all those facilities. It became only residential villages with time, which means that the whole lifestyle, it's not traditional too, because we're in 2021, but it's not modern also. So if you want to go out with your friends, you don't have where to go. So you have to go to like someone's house or whatever. And imagine this with the traditional family conservative lifestyle. You cannot leave that lifestyle. You cannot change it or work towards a better community because you're stuck there. The only way where to live is to live within your family household still, or in the same unit or above your parents or whatever. And all family relatives live approximately around each other. So it enforced this lifestyle. Our other main problem that's other than the housing problem and the planning problem is the crime rate, because Israel is not interested and they distribute guns. So whatever guns people can get, they're getting from police, from army. So yeah, we have criminal families, we have high crime rate, all within those very dense neighborhoods or cities.
And you're saying a lot of the guns that end up in the hands of Palestinian communities, how does that work exactly? How do they end up in people's hands? Yeah.
Both from policemen and from army. We don't control borders. We don't have any way to get guns from anywhere. And Israel is not interested in enforcing any law that prevent people from having their guns. So it's illegal. It's illegal. It's not like the US. It is illegal, but Israel doesn't enforce the law for decades now. And after decades of not enforcing such an important law, you know, people will just protect themselves because of the chaos that started happening. And yeah, it is from police and army, and it is known how it's transferred to us, how the policemen, you know, sell them. It's a black market of guns. So that's the image kind of how stuck those villages are in terms of planning and developing industrial areas, education facilities, public facilities, etc. But then what is happening is that it's hard to live there. And when it's hard to live there, we're studying, we're seeing that, oh, we should live in a better place. And we try to go to the cities, and the cities are kind of closed borders for us. The Jewish cities, they don't have space for us, not schools, racism, etc. So it's very hard to live in those Jewish cities or committees that legally prevent us from buying houses. So we go to the historic villages like Haifa or Yaffa or those areas where there were historic Palestinian community, and today it's like mixed cities, and we live there. We live also in like those development towns too, in the mm-hmm. north, or because it's cheaper sometimes to buy a house there. It's a town, it's not, they don't have committees, but still, if you live there, it's very hard to commute to your school, to your kids, you know, needs, whatever, but still there are no other options. And those development towns, they were built on our lands. That was the goal. Yeah. So they're very close to us. Which worked. Now it's funny, like, yeah, they built it in order to make the Galilee Jewish, but then, oh, suddenly we have kind of towns near us where we can commute and live. Not everyone can do that, but some people can. Or we go to Haifa or those historic urban centers, and that's like the only way to live an urbanized life outside of those villages.
So I wanted us to talk about the mixed cities. First, mm-hmm. let's explain a little bit what mixed city means.
Well, that's actually not a good term to use, but that's how we call them usually, mm-hmm. mixed cities. It's an occupied city that used to be a Palestinian city, but then because it's a city, it was easier for Jewish people during the British mandate to live there. And later on in 1948, we were expelled. Some of their neighborhoods were demolished and it became a Jewish-only city with a Palestinian neighborhood. So let's talk, for example, about Haifa and Yaffa, Akka. Those are the cities that I'm talking about. So what happened, for example, in Haifa is that it used to be, it's a Palestinian city. It was built like 3,000 years ago. What happened during the British mandate is that it was a very important city because of the port, and so on. So it was a growing city, and many Jewish people lived there. They were coming from Europe. It's a good target where they can live and grow economically. They built new neighborhoods for Jewish people to move freely. And after that, in 1948, those cities were, you know, during the Nakba, the Palestinian neighborhoods were demolished. People were expelled. So Haifa, for example, I think from 70,000 Palestinians that lived in Haifa, only 3,000 remained. And they were forced to move into one neighborhood, that is Wadi Nisnas. It became like a ghetto. So whoever remained in Haifa and was not expelled lived in one particular neighborhood. And people that were expelled from cities, because it was on the shoreline, like on the sea, so they were expelled by boats. They're not internal displaced. They didn't move to Palestinian villages, they moved outside to Lebanon or other places. So we lost also the urban community. We lost those group of people, and who remained were basically mostly people of the villages. That's another transformation of the Palestinian community. Coming back to those people, to the Palestinians who remained, they were forced into one neighborhood. Wadi Nisnas, for example, in Haifa, Ajami in Yafa, the historic Akka, like the historic city in Akka, the old city. Whoever remained there, they, and also I talked about the property laws that transformed the ownership. So all the houses that are empty now, they were transformed to state ownership, controlled by governmental companies. And people who were forced to move to Wadi Nisnas, for example, they were forced to move not to their houses. They were forced to move to houses that is now owned by the government.
So they were renters.
Yeah. So they became renters. Those houses are for Palestinians. So everyone will know who's this house for. So it's also very hard to know that people as the Palestinian living in Lebanon, you know that there is another Palestinian family, for example, living in your house or whatever. That became the reality. Those ghetto neighborhoods became very poor until today. But then, because it's a city, it's urban life, and it was easier for Palestinians to move. And Haifa was in the north, for example, Akka too, where most of the Palestinians, around 60% of Palestinians that remained in historic Palestine live in the north. So we were able, mostly during the 1990s, to rent houses there, to start a new life in the city. So Haifa today, for example, is kind of the capital of Palestinians in Israel because of that situation. But then what is happening is that old neighborhoods, some of them were demolished, as I said. In Haifa, for example, they just demolished the old city that Taher al-Omar built, where people lived. They just demolished it and built new governmental offices and buildings. And
you're talking also about historical sites, like heritage sites, also were destroyed. Like the character of these cities that are thousands of years old was essentially altered. Very little is left of it.
Exactly. It was demolished, literally. So you don't see it. And when you go to some of the neighborhoods that remained or survived, you'll see some houses and you can kind of imagine how Haifa was before. So for example, in Haifa, Wadi Nisnas is one example because it wasn't demolished. Another example is Wadi Salib that was not demolished, as I said, because Mizrahi Jews lived there. So they moved to Wadi Salib, and then until the government expelled them again from those houses, it was then hard to demolish because it was later in 1950s where Israel is now a state and the war ended. So they don't demolish anymore in the same way that they demolished during the Nakba. Then during the Nakba, when they decided that they want to demolish the old city, the planner, and I'm citing him now, he said that what he wanted is clearing the area for a new city was one way of replacing the hostile cityscape of the other, which means the Arab, with an appropriate environment for the new Jew. And this was Shaviv's planning, the winning competition for the what is known now as the governmental offices in Haifa, the high scape buildings that is very close to Wadi Salib. So and now what is happening to those places that remain, like Wadi Salib, for example, that is owned by the state because of the property thing, the absentees law. It's all by the state, but they're turning it into neighborhoods for artists, and they're encouraging people to rent like studios, art spaces there. And now they're starting another residential project there. So it will become like the old city of Yafa. If you go to Yaffa, it's a very beautiful old city, and you will see it's empty. It's not the native people that living there. Who's living there are very rich Jewish, mostly artists. They build boutique hotels. It's like the image of gentrification that we know from all over the world, but the difference here is that it's very ethnic too.
Yeah, I definitely wanted us to unpack a little bit how a lot of the removal of Palestinians continues to this day in many of those historic cities, whether it's Akka, Acre, or Haifa. And definitely we see writings describing what's happening as gentrification, but perhaps that may neutralize a little bit the political and racial nature of what goes on.
Gentrification is correct in terms of the process, but it makes it like the whole international idea of gentrification that's happening everywhere. It's not the same, because in those areas, in those old cities, people don't own their houses. Some of them do, but many of them don't own their houses because of, as I said, they live in the state-owned houses. And then what happens is that those companies will decide that, oh, we have an investor that want to buy those houses for a lot of money, and they can sell it. And then what they say, okay, you as a renter, you can rent from them instead of renting from us as a state company. And then they will not become a protected renter anymore. Or other options too is that because of those places becoming like a hotspot, and investors are coming from all over the world to buy those houses, they're ready to pay those people enough money to leave. And when I say enough money, this money is not enough for them to buy another house in another place. It's a lot of money, but it's problematic too, because then the Palestinian environment that is known there will disappear. People cannot afford living in a place that is surrounded by boutique hotels. They cannot anymore have their small shop there. So many of them leave. And don't forget, like we're talking about poverty neighborhoods where many other social problems happening there, like crime, other things in the old city of Akka. They encourage people to leave. Also, for example, the Israelis are building a new Arab town. That's how they call it. It's called Tantura. That's the only place that was planned. It's not happening yet, but that was planned for Arabs since 1948. Nothing was built, no expansion, no new cities, nothing, but the concentration cities of Bedouin. That's not counted, but no new city was built for us. And now they're deciding, oh, we want to build a new Arab town in the Galilee area, very close to Akka. It's a very bad plan. It's a very dense, unfair on the lands of Arab Palestinians living in the next village, but their lands were expropriated during the 1970s. But instead of giving them the land back, they're building a new city there. One of the goals of this city is basically to absorb people leaving Akka. We may see within, I don't know, a decade or so that people are actually leaving Akka.
I wanted to understand if there's a role for settler organizations in these areas that get emptied of Palestinian population. Is there any similarity that can be drawn or comparison that we can see between how we see settlement expansion in the West Bank, for example, or forced evictions and home demolitions in Jerusalem, and what happens inside communities of Palestinians inside Israel?
Yeah, there are a group of settlers, like those people who are working in Sheikh Jarrah, for example, bringing people to live between Palestinians in their house. There are similar groups working in Lid, Ramle. I don't know if you've heard about what happened in Lid, for example, last month during the uprising, where those are settlers, basically.
Just for our listeners that didn't follow, maybe just to explain a little bit very briefly what happened in Lid.
Lid is one of those historic Palestinian cities. It's the same story like Haifa, Akka, Yaffa, etc. The Palestinian community that remained there remained in a very particular area, and then the city became Jewish city, mostly Jewish. And there are those group and organizations that are encouraging settlers to come and buy houses and live in those neighborhoods in Lid. During the uprising, one young man was killed by a settler there. And then Jewish settlers were coming from all over the place by buses to Lid. They were beating people in the street, calling like death for Arabs, breaking into houses, and they were protected by the police. Even the police was helping them. They also controlled the big mosque. It's called the big mosque there. And they were throwing bombs into the mosque. Maybe here we can talk about also all those mixed that we call mixed cities. It's like occupied cities. In all those cities, clashes happened on a daily basis during May. Because in those places, Palestinians live in those ghettos, poor neighborhoods. And then settlers and Israelis live very next to them, very close to them. Palestinians are minority, so it's easier to attack them. It's easier than going into a Palestinian village in the Galilee or in the Naqab, in the desert. So they broke into houses, into neighborhoods. They organized buses in all those cities, in Haifa, in Yafa, Akka. In Akka, the police just closed the old city and prevented the Palestinians from leaving the old city, and then left the Jewish settlers going by bus to another Arab neighborhood that's outside the old city. They broke into houses, they were breaking cars, trying to fire houses. It was a big, big clash between police and those Zionist Jewish settlers and Palestinians living in those mixed cities. And that was the image in all those cities. So yeah, talking about groups or organization, yeah, they are very organized. They organized themselves very well. We saw them working like an army during May. And this is how they work when they sell houses, when they see a neighborhood as a real estate opportunity and decide, oh, here we go, we will buy those houses and then we will encourage people to rent them or whatever. They work as an organization in many places.
Lama Shahada is a Palestinian architect and urban planner whose research focuses on the intersection of architecture and urban planning with spatial justice, environmental and political conflicts, and social formation. She's working on master plans for Palestinian towns and villages within 1948's borders. Please join us next week for the second part of this interview. She spoke with Momina's Mira Nabulsi. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
وين بديكي انا نسكن بعرف انه البيت قديم وشايف عيونك حزيني بس انا شو بقدر اعمل قدام الوحش العظيم عم بنهش بطن المدينة وين بديكي انا نسكن بعرف انه البيت قديم وشايف عيونك حزيني بس انا شو بقدر اعمل قدام الوحش العظيم عم بنهش بطن المدينة مين قال انه الشوارع رح تضل نفس الاشي مين قال انه المدينة بعدها بتنقطع ماشي مين قال انه الحارات بعدها لعبتنا البريئة مين سرق منا الطبيعة وقالنا حافظوا على البيئة مين حط السوق بمول مين طلعنا من البيوت مين قسمها ومين أجرنا استوديو أصغر من تابوت مين أجا من تل أبيب قصدي مين أجا من بولندا مين عمر براج أزاز وإحنا هدلنا البراندا
And that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
Our media partner is a Status Hour podcast. You can find us on Twitter at @Vomina_radio or listen to our past shows on iTunes or SoundCloud at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. You can also reach us by email at vominaradio@gmail.com. Please join us next week for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, and thank you for listening.
With the It Pays to Be Vaccinated contest, your COVID-19 vaccination could pay off big time. Every Friday in August, you could win $150,000 and two scholarships of $10,000. Plus, if you've had both shots September 3rd, there's a draw for 16 scholarships of $20,000 and a jackpot of $1 million. Register now for the It Pays to Be Vaccinated contest at quebec.ca/vaccination contest. The sooner you're vaccinated, the faster you can take part. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere des Prairies Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
It contains strong language and some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
All the Way Live Radio, CKUT, 90.3 FM, every single Wednesday from 3 to 5. This is Pro V. Thank you very much for tuning in. Today's show is just going to be a whole bunch of random hip-hop. I'm going to be going straight in for 2 hours. Hope you enjoy all the music. And let's talk more music. All the Way Live Radio, CKUT, 90.3 FM.